The Tom Woods Show, episode 539.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Want to know an easy way to be a hero to all your libertarian friends and relatives? With a gift subscription to LibertyClassroom.com, where they can learn the history and economics they didn't get in school. Watch for a special Black Friday discount. Welcome to this roundtable discussion on the Paris attacks and the future. And joining us on this roundtable are three people, two of whom I've featured in the past and one of whom is new to the program. The new person is Daniel Larrison of the American Conservative, where he is senior editor. He also has his own personal blog there. He also holds a PhD in history from the University of Chicago. Then Daniel McAdams, who is no stranger to this program. Daniel is executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, ronpaulinstitute.org. And Eric Margolies, who is a foreign affairs expert and columnist, also the author of American Raj, The West and the Muslim World. Information about the guests can be found at tomwoods.com/539. Now, after my conversation with these gentlemen, make sure and stay tuned at the end, because I have a couple of little announcements that will be useful, especially if you're a student. A couple of opportunities I want to make sure you're aware of and you may not find out about any other way. So definitely stay tuned for that. Let's turn now to our discussion. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Tom. A distinctive pleasure. Thank you.
I have never had three people on the show with me at once. This is going to be tremendous. I want to, of course, talk about what happened in Paris. And as I've told the listeners, I got so far ahead in episodes, and they're all numbered, that when this happened, I couldn't do an episode right away. There was nowhere to insert it. So we're getting to it better late than never. Of course, the issues it raises are perennial and unlikely to be going away anytime soon. So better late than never. What I want to start off with is the obvious question here in light of these attacks. Well, there are a lot of obvious questions, right? What does this do to the GOP race? What does it do to American politics? Where are they likely to go in the future in terms of foreign policy? Let's, I guess, start with what is it plausible to say that this is a case of blowback, or do we, in fact, have to say in a case like this that maybe there is a problem with Islam itself? Let's start with controversy here. Let's start with Daniel McAdams.
Me?
Yeah, I'm going to put you on the hot seat. That's what you get for being a longtime guest of the show.
Oh, no. Okay, blowback. Yes, it's blowback. France has been extremely aggressive in the Middle East, particularly with its former colonies for a number of years. France was, as your listeners will remember, was in the turbo seat of the Libya regime change operation. Sarkozy was hectoring the U.S. constantly to get on board. France has been selling, giving, whatever you want to do, weapons to a lot of to rebels in Syria, including the more radical factions. It got its foot in the stuck its foot in the fire and got burned.
What do you other let's go to Dan Larrison. How do you assess this?
I think a lot of that's I think that's basically right. I agree with Daniel. You see very clearly both in the French case and in the Russian case, it really almost immediate blowback to their decisions to start bombing in Syria. Of course, the Russian Metrojet plane was blown up over the Sinai in what appears to be a straightforward case of retribution for Russian intervention. And in the statement claiming responsibility for the attacks in Paris, ISIS declared that bombing Syria was one of the principal reasons why they were being targeted. So I think here it's really more clear-cut than you often get in these cases. And while there may be problems within Islam, that doesn't explain why this attack at this particular time.
Eric, let me ask you. I get in my Facebook feed quite a bit an image in which there's a lot of text, and they list all these different terrorist events from the past 10 or so years. And they list every single one, and they say, was committed by Muslims, was committed by Muslims, was committed by Muslims. And, of course, the lesson we're supposed to draw from this is not especially subtle, because they'll say, look, I don't see any Quakers who are shooting up civilians. I don't see anybody who's terrified of the Amish. So obviously there must be something unique to Islam, given that there are so many people no one in his right mind would be afraid of. What do you say to that?
Well, this is the response of many small-minded, ignorant people. It's also the party line being promoted by the active enemies of the Arab world and of Muslims. We have people in the States who are spending $3 million a year promoting hatred of Islam. It's being promoted by fundamentalist Christian religious groups here who embarked on some kind of crusade. In fact, to make that argument, you could also turn around and say, well, you know, World War II was started by Christians, and they're all over the place, and we should do something to deport them, or they shouldn't be allowed to have any positions of prominence. In my view, as an old Middle East hand, this is not about religion. ISIS is not about religion. They barely can call themselves Muslims. They go through the motions, but in fact, they're a bunch of 20-something anarchists who use the vocabulary of Islam to advance their causes. But nothing that they preach is consonant with the tenets and teachings of real Islam.
Well, I do have to say, even though I'm not an expert on Islam, I do know something about Christianity, and I know something about Catholicism, and I find that a lot of times people, when they know that I'm a theologically conservative Catholic, they think they know a lot of other things about me. They think they know what my foreign policy is, and they don't. I have exactly the opposite foreign policy of what a lot of people who describe themselves religiously the way I do have. And so a lot of times I myself find myself saying, well, yeah, I think I'm actually upholding what would be a Christian foreign policy, unlike 99% of the people who call themselves Christians. So I do find myself in rather a similar situation quite a bit of the time. A lot of this revolves around Syria in particular. Can any of you gentlemen, and anybody who wants to speak first can take this, can any of you gentlemen identify for me a coherent explanation of, try to formulate a coherent explanation of U.S. policy in Syria?
Don't everybody answer first.
Yeah, don't everybody answer all at once.
I'll go first.
Yeah, Daniel, you get it again.
I'll make it quick because I'm sure the other guests will fill in the blank more. But it's the philosophy of regime change. The idea that after the end of the Cold War, and I think Eric wrote about this recently, the idea that after the end of the Cold War, this peace dividend that was promised to us is gone because a number of different interest groups, including particularly the military-industrial complex, needed conflict to continue. So one of the things was to remake the Middle East using regime change. We know that Syria was planned as early as the early to mid-2000s. We know that from WikiLeaks. The U.S. was active in fomenting the entire phony Arab Spring operations. And the idea is still regime change. You know, John Kerry was quoted in the New York Times just yesterday saying that a ceasefire and political transition in Syria is crucial to defeating ISIS. Now, tell me if that makes any sense whatsoever.
Eric, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I'd like to just say that I've been following American policy in Syria for a long time, and it is probably the most screwed up, poorly thought out, confused foreign policy issue that I've ever seen. And I ascribe this to the fact that the government is too many cooks are spoiling the broth. Too many special interests are stirring the pot. And what America is doing is like a bull in a china shop. It's relentlessly destroying the Middle East. It's destroying Afghanistan, Iraq, now Syria, Lebanon has been pounded, Sudan has been divided. The Shabab down in the coast in Somalia, that area has been torn apart. In essence, the United States is like a giant Rome plow just crashing its way through the Middle East. And out of the ruins of this thing are coming all these horrible groups, some of whom we've created.
Do you think there's, well, let me put it this way. When we when we look at the way the intervention in Syria and the U.S. position in Syria is pitched to the American public, it's pitched in terms of we're dealing with a really bad guy who's done really bad things, and we just have to get rid of this fellow Assad. We've got to get rid of this guy because we're just morally compelled to. When you look at it from a distance, though, you realize that, well, if Saudi Arabia is conniving at undermining Assad, this can't ultimately be about liberty versus tyranny. If Saudi Arabia is on your side, maybe it's about something a little bit more mundane. Certainly in Saudi Arabia's case, maybe they would like to undermine an Iranian ally, namely the Assad regime in Syria. I mean, are we, in other words, are we dealing with something a little bit more mundane here than regime change from going from a tyranny to a liberal democracy? Is there something else maybe at work?
Yeah, well, I think that hits on something I was going to get to, which is that a lot of this is driven by the obsession with curbing or pushing back on Iranian influence in the region. Where we're seeing this in the way that we've enabled the Saudis and the Gulf states to wreak havoc in Syria, and we're seeing it in our support for them doing the same thing in Yemen. There's this indulgence of what's really a sectarian rivalry with the Iranians and their allies by lending all the support that we can to the Saudis and the Gulf states, who of course have no scruples about doing deals and backing jihadist groups.
All right, is there anything then that the U.S. could do that could improve the situation? I mean, in other words, the French launched a bombing campaign to the cheers of the world. I don't know what kind of effect it had, but is there anything militarily that the U.S. can do? I mean, after all, we are dealing with a particularly vicious group of people, and there would be a tremendous support for going after them, but how would you go after them, and is there a way of going after them that doesn't make the problem worse?
If I can jump in, Tom, sorry, but I just have to share my terrible sense of apprehension that, and I don't want to get heavy into conspiracy, but that this whole thing is, at least it's being used as a propaganda ploy to get Americans on the side of a full ground war in Syria. There was a Bloomberg poll out today showing that 53% of Americans support U.S.-Russia military cooperation to fight ISIS. They're evenly split on whether to send ground troops into Iraq and Syria. These kinds of spectacular events tend to coalesce the American view toward war, where we had not long ago the Americans resoundingly opposed to going back into these places. This whole idea, and the Russians are embracing it too, they would love to have this idea of a wonderful world coalition fighting ISIS. It is absolutely not our fight. The Russians started in with very limited goals, which is simply to give a boost to Assad's army, the legitimate government of Syria. If theirs turns into a worldwide crusade against ISIS, it'll only come back to haunt and hurt the United States.
Yeah, I would say, watching this whole episode about Syria, I've been absolutely astounded by the amount of lies and disinformation and double talk that's come to us through the media. I used to think the old Soviet media was bad, but we've gone a great leap forward beyond them in promoting government policies. The American public is completely, well, as Mark Twain said, if you don't read the papers, you're uninformed. If you do read them, you're misinformed. And that is just where we are now. We have the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and the Washington Post, the three pillars of neocon policy, urging us into a war there. We are completely blanked out news about Saudi backing for ISIS and for American backing. After all, we and the Saudis created ISIS or helped create them. We midwifed ISIS, hoping that they would be the Mujahideen of the year 2005, and we would go and turn them against, first of all, the Syrians, as you said, who were allied with Iran, but also eventually against Iran, too. And they could be used in Afghanistan. That's the other hope, to be turned against Taliban. So this is our monster that we've created, but we can't admit that this monster's run out of control now and is a bloody bunch of lunatics. But war in that region would benefit only one country, and that is the Israelis, who would love to see Syria torn apart, would love to see the Syria's Golan Heights sort of vanish from Syrian control forever, and would get some room for possible expansion to the east.
Eric, would you mind if I asked you to flesh out a bit the argument that the U.S. husbanded ISIS in one way or another? Because, I mean, I know I've heard the claim, but I'd like to hear some specifics about it, because people are going to find that controversial.
Well, yes, of course. People generally in the States don't know that ISIS began in the American prison camps in Iraq, or that about half of the senior membership of ISIS, if not more, are former officers of Saddam Hussein's Republican Guards. You know, when we invaded Iraq, President Saddam, let me say, because we never give him his right title, President Saddam said, "This will be the mother of all battles," and we laughed at him. But here we are, years later, still fighting in Iraq and still fighting in this area. The finance for the ISIS was done largely by Saudi Arabia. The arms were provided from Turkey, which has its own acts in this conflict for weird reasons, was provided through Turkey and the Gulf states. And I believe firmly that we have secreted special forces, U.S. and French particularly, into the battle in Syria, that we, the CIA, organized the original uprising against President Assad, which was a cookie-cutter carbon copy of the way the uprising was started against Gaddafi in Libya. So all roads point to Western backing. The Russians have been saying this forever, and for once they're right.
But what about this? And anybody can take this one. This is the sort of argument I will read in the press all the time. If there's an attack of this nature that is absolutely barbaric on the French civilian population, and the French response is to then withdraw from the Middle East and more or less abandon its policy, then this will be viewed as a sign of weakness, and the French will actually wind up suffering further as a result, that they have to project an image of strength after an attack like this, because that's what these people understand. Anybody want to respond?
Well, I think one of the things that you come across with that is that almost everyone that makes that claim has always been agitating for a more aggressive policy in Syria or anywhere else in the region. There's always this claim that the failure to do that, quote-unquote failure to do that, will project weakness, but it's never actually put to the test. Why is someone going to come after them more aggressively if they withdraw from Syria, if they stop bombing Syria? It doesn't really follow, especially if you accept that they would have been attacked because they started bombing Syria. It seems politically untenable for a politician, say President Hollande, to advocate for such a policy in the wake of these attacks, and yet that would clearly be the more responsible thing for him to do.
Well, he's...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Tom. I was just going to say, in some ways, you know, the horse may be out of the barn, because France's immigration policy has been pretty liberal, so to speak, when it comes to Muslims, and I'm not, you know, necessarily advocating for closed borders, but they may have already let it out. But if I can just respond with an anecdote on your previous question, if you recognize that alcohol is destroying your body and health, but you say, well, I can't quit drinking, it'll just be a sign of weakness. You know, if you're doing something that's causing problems, the sign of strength is to stop doing it. And if French intervention in the Middle East is causing these sorts of problems, the solution, the sign of strength would be to stop doing it.
Well, that's right. If I may add that, another angle to this, which has been poorly addressed, is the fact that the French are up to so many machinations in the Levant. that there are beliefs, it's certainly in the Middle East, that the French are intent on reestablishing their sphere of influence over Lebanon and Syria, that France and Syria have been at scimitars drawn for decades over Lebanon, which France is seeking to dominate. So never mind whether at all is what France is doing in sub-Saharan Africa. But don't forget also Algeria, where I remember covering the Algerian war. And, you know, people are saying, oh, this is the worst atrocity, this shooting last weekend that's ever happened in Paris. Not true. The worst atrocity, I was there when it happened. 200 Algerians who were demonstrating for independence of Algeria were beaten to death or shot and thrown in the Seine River. Atrocities committed against Arabs don't seem to count as much against white Europeans. With the attacks that ISIS has made, the orange jumpsuits for its victims that it shows, clear reference to Guantanamo prisoners, burning a pilot alive, horrible, in a cage. These other bombings and things, they all are staged by ISIS as retaliation. I'm not trying to justify them in any way, but we have to understand what the thinking is of this outlaw group.
In social media, there has been quite a bit of activity among self-described conservatives in the days following the attacks, and I have seen myself, I've seen images of nuclear explosions saying that maybe what these people need is the bright light of freedom. It's a reference to a nuclear weapon being used against them, and people are cheering this. These are the conservatives who lecture us all day long about moral relativism being what's going to undo America. But I am seeing more and more calls for this, and apparently the other day Ted Cruz was saying we have to just take this war where it needs to go and not be so concerned about civilian casualties. I don't even think I have a question here. I think I just need some comment about this because was the conservative movement always like this? Were they always acting this way and I just didn't notice it because I was a conservative at the time? I don't know.
Well, once upon a time, there were very strong conservative voices speaking out against the first use of nuclear weapons by our government at the end of World War II. There were Richard Weaver, for instance, found the use of nuclear weapons appalling. And there are certainly many people over the years that have echoed those same sentiments. But what you see with these sorts of calls for mass murder, which is what they are, is the complete failure to respect the sorts of principles of protecting civilian life that ought to be paramount for us, but which sadly are not.
And if conservatism finds its base in Christian and religious values, you can't forget, you know, some of the most important aspects of the just war theory, which is that once a war has started, you must do everything possible to protect civilian lives. So they're certainly not acting in any way as Christians to support such a move.
There was a poll which I quoted in my book, American Mirage, about that was taken shortly before the invasion of Iraq. A reputable poll, and by Scripps or some other good organization. And they found that almost over 80%, maybe it was 85% of evangelical Christians who had been queried were ardent supporters of attacking Iraq and invading Iraq. These were the Christians. Somehow our American version of Christianity, which is completely different from that of Europe, has gone off the tracks and become a very militant organization. And the conservatives, you know, other polls showed 44-45% of people who call themselves Republicans also call themselves born-again Christians. And they get their information from these Bible TV preachers and from religious stations and of course, Fox News, but not from the real world. And they're very militant, too. And, you know, if they'd lived 50 years ago, we'd be calling these people either imperialists or kind of neo-fascists. But now we call them conservatives.
I think it's fair to say that American political rhetoric is likely to get even more hawkish than it's already been. And we certainly we see that among the Republicans, but obviously Hillary Clinton will get even more hawkish. So no matter who the nominee is in either party, I mean, at least going by the current poll numbers, it seems pretty likely we're going to have two hawks debating each other, trying to out-hawk each other in the lead-up to the 2016 election with a new president in power. Now, I mean, this is still a ways away. It's possible that Obama could do something, but it seems that American policy could be on the verge of taking another hawkish sort of turn. Now, given that ISIS is obviously not invincible, I mean, is it metaphysically impossible that there could be a military campaign that could be successful against them, given that it's at least plausible that one could be tried?
One could be tried. The question is, what is the cost that Americans are actually willing to bear versus what they think they're willing to bear at the beginning? When these campaigns begin, there's often a great surge of support for them. But as the costs begin to roll in, as casualties begin to be taken and more Americans lose their lives, the public pretty quickly sours on these missions, especially when they don't seem to have a clear goal or clear end. And any sort of ground campaign in Syria would not be limited, I fear, only to eliminating ISIS. It would then be diverted against the Syrian government. And even if that's not the case, U.S. soldiers would still be stuck in Syria as some sort of stabilizing force for who knows how long. So that's the real concern. It's not that it couldn't be done, but it would be done at such a high cost. And there's no compelling interest for the U.S. to do it.
I would just say that I think it is pretty close to metaphysically impossible. I think Dan has some points, but it's pretty close to metaphysically impossible because this war against ISIS, this war against terrorism is a war against a philosophy, is a war against a tactic. It ignores the impetus for that tactic, and the impetus is Western intervention in the region, American intervention. You know, Professor Robert Pape studied this. It's a very, you know, in his famous book. It's a war against this. And if you continue doing this, no matter how many people you kill, there will always be someone else to come. They, just as we would not want to be occupied and meddled with and told what to do, the same is true for people in the Middle East.
Well, and on top of that, I could add that there are elements, pressure groups in the United States who want to see American troops go into Syria precisely to fight the Syrian army and then go on to fight Iran, having failed to force Iran to give up completely its nuclear capabilities, even civilian ones. The idea is now to provoke a war with Iran, which would allow for them to be wrecked. The idea that how many wars have we fought? I was in the army during the Vietnam days. We got our derrieres kicked there. We lost the war in Afghanistan. We lost the war in Iraq. And yet here we are advising people on how to fight wars and now threatening to send troops. Our constant reaction to complex foreign policy issues is bombardment and sending in the special forces. Unfortunately, most of our politicians in Washington have no knowledge or negative knowledge of the Middle East. Look at this Ted Cruz, look at Dr. What's-His-Name, who doesn't know that the Chinese aren't in Syria. Foreigners looking at this are horrified. There's having one of these people have become president. It's not just president of the U.S., it's emperor of the whole non-Russian, Chinese, Indian world. And it's terrifying that people of so little knowledge are allowed to fulminate and push a pro-war line.
Well, I want to let you gentlemen go. I'm just wondering the likelihood that we'll see substantial U.S. intervention in the wake of these attacks. Over the next 12 months, 12 to 18 months, let's allow for the new president. Hard to predict what sorts of it's a hard question I'm asking you. But the fact is that since Afghanistan and Iraq have begun to wind down, there hasn't been a huge appetite for intervention, but now it seems among the public maybe there is. Do you think we're going to get it? What's it going to look like?
Well, this is all media manipulation. In the past 24 hours, 164 people have been killed or wounded in Yemen. but the world does not care at all because these are the victims of us and our allies, the Saudi Arabians, you know. There's just no concern. So this is ginned up. Here's the real danger, in my opinion. If people like Lindsey Graham, and by no means is he alone, but he tweeted today that he's going to introduce an authorization for the use of military force against ISIS. And listen how he describes it. Not limited by time, geography, or means. If let that sink in for a second, it's not very hard to extrapolate that he's thinking about drone strikes on Americans on American soil. If think about it, put it together. So the real danger is to us at home, from our own government, from the people in Washington using this to have a wider war. Will the U.S. be on the ground in Syria soon in a big way? My bet would be yes.
That's my fear as well. Certainly by the time you have the next administration, there is going to be a big push for escalation. And Congress is clearly not interested in bringing that in. In fact, almost everyone in Congress is going to be in favor of it, I imagine. And the problem is not so much that there's a public appetite for more intervention, but that there isn't substantial and really overwhelming opposition to it. So the escalation is going to happen, and people are going to acquiesce in it.
Eric, I'll give you the final word here.
Thank you. I'm afraid I agree with my colleagues that there will be another attack. I'm surprised that there hasn't been a major attack in London. It's probably in the works. And one against the United States seems to be inevitable, an incident. It can be two or three guys with Kalashnikovs, but it's enough to stir up pandemonium, race fear, religious hatred in the United States. We see it busting out all over. So yes, there will be an American intervention because of bombing ISIS. Can you imagine we have the U.S., French, Russian, and up until recently Canadian Air Force plus the Arab states bombing this miserable little town of Raqqa in Iraq? I saw heavy bombers being used by yesterday. We're making the sand bounce there, and that is not going to solve the problem. We will send troops, and if we do send troops, they're going to end up chasing these ISIS people all over Mesopotamia.
Well, I only wish that the three of you gentlemen had more of an opportunity to speak to the American public, so Americans were not just tuning in on the cable channels to retired generals who are now consultants for military companies. But unfortunately, that is the situation that we face. Well, we appreciate your time, everybody who listens to the show, and I myself appreciate your time very much. It was wonderful to have all three of you here with us. I'll link to books of yours. I'll link to your sites and everything you're up to at tomwoods.com/539. For this being episode number 539. Thanks so much, everybody. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure, Tom.
All right, tomwoods.com/539 is where to go for more on this topic. Also, I'm going to be linking at tomwoods.com/539 the following two items, which are important primarily to students. And the first of them is the Austrian Student Scholars Conference, which is taking place February 26th and 27th, 2016, at Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania. I keynoted this event several years ago, so I can tell you from firsthand experience, it's a wonderful event, and it's a great opportunity for you, even as an undergraduate, although it's also for graduate students, to have an opportunity to give a paper at a professional conference. This will give you a leg up compared to basically almost anybody else. But it's not only a wonderful opportunity to present a paper, to listen to presentations, to get to know other young Austrian scholars, but also there's prize money, $1,500 for the first place paper, then $1,000 for the second place paper, and $500 for the third place paper. And incidentally, when I mentioned this conference a couple years ago here on the show, a listener of the show heard the announcement, submitted a paper proposal, went to the conference, delivered the paper, and won the first prize. How about that? So let's keep the Tom Woods Show dynasty going, winning the prizes over at the Austrian Student Scholars Conference. So you can check that out. I will be linking to it at tomwoods.com/539. If you don't remember that number, you can always Google Austrian Student Scholars Conference and the page will come right up. The second thing is the Mises Institute is now taking applications for their summer fellow program. This was really my favorite thing about the Mises Institute when I was there. I used to be a resident scholar at the Mises Institute from 2006 to 2010, so I lived right in Auburn, Alabama. And my family and I always looked forward to the arrival of the summer fellows every summer because these were wonderful people to get to know. We used to have parties over at our house. These are some of my fondest memories. And it's an opportunity, the fellows program, to work on what we hope will become a publishable article that, again, will be something that will make you stand out on the academic job market. So this is primarily for graduate students. And you'll be able to work under the supervision of Academic Vice President Joe Salerno and also Senior Fellow Mark Thornton. So it's a tremendous opportunity. It's really going to be the summer of a lifetime for you. So if that holds any interest for you, then to also check out tomwoods.com/539 because I will link to the Mises Institute Summer Fellows Program on that page. All right, that's all I have to tell you for today. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.